Welcome to Energy Unplugged, the go-to podcast focusing on the global energy transition. My name is Emma Woodward, and I'm Aurora's European Hydrogen Market Lead. I'm joined today by Andrew Doyle, Executive Director at MUFG. Andrew joined MUFG in March 2011 and now has over 20 years of project finance experience, covering large thermal power and renewables projects across the UK and Europe, as well as in the Middle East. Andrew is also a member of the Hydrogen Advisory Council, providing advice and insight on the UK's hydrogen strategy, and is also an active participant on DESNZ and previously BESA's CCUS roundtables. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Good to be here.
So today we're going to be focusing on the topic of hydrogen. And I just want to start off from a broader perspective. How are you seeing investor appetite for hydrogen today? And when might we expect to see this being translated into actual projects being developed?
So I see a lot of interest still in hydrogen, and we still have lots of discussions with our key clients around this topic. I think we're really encouraged by the progress that we've seen on the recent auctions, both in the UK and for the European Hydrogen Bank. You know, the first round in the UK with 125 megawatts is small, but it's a start. And I think it's really encouraging to see that coming forward so quickly. And on the European Hydrogen Bank side, you know, I think they've had 132 bids, you know, equivalent to about 8.5 gigawatts of capacity. So I think there's a lot of interest and appetite for projects that are coming forward. Yeah, it probably has taken a bit longer to get here than we might have expected, but I think we're now starting to see some momentum.
Great. And from MUFG's side, what kind of key developments are you seeing? What are the sorts of projects that you're working on at the moment?
So we do have a couple of advisory mandates that we're very proud of. We're working on a green hydrogen project in Asia, and also a blue ammonia project in Canada. Both of these are targeting the Japanese subsidy regime, the CFD regime. You know, we're very, you know, pleased to be supporting our clients on these projects. And you know, it's always been an ambition of ours to be involved in these very first projects so that we can help drive the bankability story for hydrogen as a new sector.
I mean, that makes sense. And it is a great question. Like, what is it today that's ensured that these projects can actually be bankable? I mean, in the past, we've talked about a lot of the challenges surrounding bankability in terms of being able to prove, you know, access to renewable resources, being able to be certain that hydrogen could be provided at off-takers at the volumes and the scale that they needed. What has changed? What is really allowing these projects to come forward now?
So the off-take story or the business case was always the thing, I think, that was holding these projects back. So yeah, the HARB auctions and the European Hydrogen Bank, and I think more certainty, say, on the Japanese side, you know, the details are still being kind of worked through on a lot of these regulations, but it is, you know, developing, and it's then giving people more certainty that they have an investable proposition. And that is making the kind of the big difference in the approach that we're seeing on projects.
Okay, I think that makes sense. But of course, these are sort of very, very early stage developments. I think when we look at Aurora's own electrolyzer database, where we're tracking, you know, announced projects throughout the world, it's less than a fraction of a percent of projects that have been announced that have actually, you know, reached the development stage. The vast majority of them are still in some form of planning process or pre-FID. So there's clearly a lot of steps and a lot of gaps that still need to be filled before people are really willing, you know, and before investors are really going to be able to take decisions on a broad scale. I wonder if you can talk to some of the remaining challenges. You know, what's the driving factor between why some of these projects that you're working on today are successful and the challenges that all of these other projects that we're looking at in the pipeline are still facing?
Sure. I mean, if we look maybe closer to home to where we're seeing opportunities in hydrogen, we are starting to have more conversations on the lending side. And it is encouraging to see the progress that's had there. I think projects like NEOM, where we were kind of a significant supporter of that project as book runner and facility agent, that's, I think, a bit of a blip, both in terms of how quickly that came to market and how big it was. And it shows the importance of having the off-taker as a key partner in that project. Where, you know, a number of the other projects which are trying to find find the offtake has been kind of constrained by, you know, people waiting to see and, you know, whether they want to enter into contracts at a particular price or whether they can potentially wait and get better value down the line. Also, the kind of the identity of those off-takers, you know, the credit quality can kind of vary, and maybe the ones that are looking to step up at this early stage, maybe some of the commodity traders might not, you know, they have good financials, but they're not a traditional corporate in terms of their kind of balance sheet and credit risk profile. So, you know, putting a kind of a 15-year view on a commodity trader is a bit of a different ask to a more industrial user. And those kind of challenges, you know, are still things that we have to kind of work through and understand. Even, you know, in the case of the UK, where we have the support mechanism, you still have that exposure to the offtaker. You get some protection around volume, but if the offtaker was to fall over, you know, you will lose access to the subsidy. So you do need to have those offtake volumes, you know, still there in order to receive the subsidy. Again, even, you know, looking to markets like Germany, I think people are looking at that from a kind of a both a mobility play, but also maybe a blending play. But again, you know, we need to kind of understand what will happen if our offtaker falls away. How does the regulatory regime kind of underpin the value of our hydrogen? And can we find an alternative offtaker, probably in that same area as well, because you can't be shipping it across country and you know, without kind of gas infrastructure. How do we still get access to the value of the regulatory framework when our offtaker has maybe gone away? And that's one of the challenges that we have to kind of work on. Then obviously we still have the technical challenges to get over. You know, it's still a very early stage. We've obviously got there on NEOM. But, you know, how do we look at other electrolyzer manufacturers? What's their track record? You know, can they fulfill the orders? What's their warranty packages that they can provide? All of these things are still areas that, you know, need to be worked through, and we'll only get worked through them as we see more and more projects coming through.
Yeah, I mean, great points again, and I think certainly tallies with our kind of view. And it highlights in many ways the importance of thinking about things like the development of hydrogen hubs as well. If you can ensure that you've got clusters of offtake in one place, it surely is going to be helping producers, but also offtakers make investment decisions, both from the producer side, knowing that there might be offtake from more than one place, and also for offtakers, if eventually there's more than one producer, it sort of helps on this pathway to a more liquid market, if you like.
Absolutely. Probably one of the challenges there then is, okay, where's the hydrogen coming from? I think the clusters do kind of benefit, say, the blue hydrogen projects, because they're able to produce the hydrogen within the clusters. If you're then kind of looking at projects that are spread around the country, you then have to think about, okay, how do we get it to the demand sources? And I think that's still a bit of a challenge that is being worked through.
Absolutely. And I think also this highlights one of the many challenges of the hydrogen economy is we can solve one problem quite easily, but we do often end up creating problems elsewhere in the value chain. But I want to stay on the offtake point, because we talk a lot about the financing of hydrogen production projects. And actually, from my perspective, I hear far, far less on, you know, how do we finance fuel switching of end users? And how do we finance transport and storage? So thinking about the end use question, if you are, say, a steel producer, like what considerations are you having to take into account when you're thinking about going about financing a fuel switch?
So this is the thing that when we speak to our clients who are looking to develop projects and they're trying to find off-takers, they are going out to, you know, the big steel producers, the ArcelorMittals and ThyssenKrupps and people that they see will, you know, provide, you know, the offtake in sufficient volumes. But on the flip side, those offtakers are looking and saying, okay, how certain can I be on the flow of hydrogen coming into my project? I also have to make a separate investment decision around fuel switching. So it's not just about, can I enter into a long-term offtake agreement? It's, I need to also spend X billion of dollars developing the new infrastructure to be able to utilize that low carbon hydrogen. They also are very kind of aware of price differentials. I think H2 Green Steel was able to actually secure a number of offtake contracts at a premium, which kind of allowed it to absorb the cost of the green hydrogen production. But this remains a kind of a key area for steel companies, particularly the European ones, when they're looking at their cost of production. They don't want to be paying significant premiums for green or even blue hydrogen. They need that to focus on the support that's available from the subsidy support regimes in order to kind of keep competitiveness with international imports. Things like the carbon border adjustment mechanisms will help with that to a degree, but they are always going to focus on securing the best possible price for hydrogen, whether it's green, blue, or grey.
Yeah, it makes sense. And then on the transport and storage side as well, I mean, in some ways, we understand how transport and storage should be financed for gas. Like, how translatable is that into hydrogen?
Yeah, again, you look at what DESNZ are doing. They see for the transport infrastructure that you can use a regulated asset base. They are also looking at kind of a revenue support regime, I think, to support the shippers. And make sure that people are not kind of overly penalized for having to pay for a network that maybe in the first years the volumes being shipped might be at the lower end. But there's nothing probably new under the sun to a certain extent. We know how to finance gas infrastructure using kind of regulated models, and I think that will be the case across the UK and Europe. What's interesting as well is DESNZ are focusing on how you can support storage. Because again, storage, I think, is seen as key to kind of unlocking maybe the seasonal kind of storage benefits that hydrogen might be able to provide. But they recognize that there's a significant investment required to be able to convert storage sites, and are offering potential kind of floor models that would allow people to be kind of certain around the kind of the return on their investment, but still also able to share some of the upside from the business case as well. I mean, interestingly, kind of one meeting that I was at a while back, the lead times for converting these kind of underground storage sites was in kind of the many years away. And the messaging there was, we kind of really need to be starting doing this now and getting kind of visibility on those business models for storage, because if we don't, then we're kind of into the 2030s before storage sites become operational. And I think we want to move at a much faster pace than that.
Yeah, I mean, if we're sort of targeting net zero at 2035, we actually don't have very much time to be thinking about the scaling up of infrastructure that we're needed, and ramping up sort of how quickly we can actually deploy projects from both the production and transport and storage and an offtake side of things. But that kind of brings me on to a point, actually, I wanted to think about current supply chain constraints, because it's sort of very, very easy, I think, for us to sit here talking, for policymakers to sort of say, okay, well, this is the pace of deployment that we need. But the reality is that we're facing a much higher cost environment today than I think anyone was really expecting 2 to 3 years ago. And supply chain constraints are going to have an impact on how quickly projects can be deployed. I mean, certainly from Aurora's perspective and based on lots of other people's forecasts that we've seen, I think we do have to accept that hydrogen prices are going to be higher than were maybe anticipated at one point, and potentially higher for longer. But do you think this is a temporary blip, or do you think there is a longer term reality that everyone is going to have to face here in what hydrogen is going to cost in the future?
Well, I think a lot of the time these inflationary pressures kind of tend to stick around, and that pricing doesn't necessarily fall quite far enough to be able to to kind of recognize that in terms of maybe like the levelized cost of electricity or levelized cost of hydrogen. I think we can see that there's actually a lot of constraints. You just have to look at how Siemens Gamesa and Plug Power, the problems that they're having. So we're you can see on the equipment manufacturer side, real challenges around their kind of business models and profitability. the only kind of real way to kind of recover that will be, you know, to try and extract kind of higher value down the line and kind of recover some of their economics. So I think to a certain extent, prices will be kind of higher. I think what's important is we need to be able to deploy these projects to be able to get those costs down. And I think it's probably helpful if governments maybe recognize that when they're setting up their support regime, they don't kind of artificially cap the subsidies available, because you might end up in a situation like in the offshore wind where you don't get bids coming through ultimately because they've set the limit, which doesn't actually reflect reality. Yeah, having said that, you know, we did see 132 bids for the European Hydrogen Bank. But equally, you could then point to the UK HAR1, where the ambition was for 250 megawatts in the first round, but actually only 125 megawatts was allocated. And, you know, a couple of big names, SSEs and BPs, actually not securing, you know, contracts in that first allocation round might show that there is maybe still a bit of a gap between where governments see the support price being and the reality of actually trying to deliver some of these early projects. So I think it's really important to start deploying projects in order to be able to achieve some of these cost savings. We've not been helped by various kind of lobby groups all showing pricing of below $2 a kilogram by 2030. When, you know, if you look at, you know, the recent kind of auction prices in the UK, and they're kind of in the $10 to $11 per kilogram region, it shows you that there's still a gap between where people see the cost going and where they are today. But we don't get to those prices unless we start deploying now and getting the learnings and getting the economies of scale and starting to drive those costs down. Without the early projects maybe carrying a bit of a premium, we never get to the levels that people kind of forecast for this stuff. So we need to be kind of having action today.
So thinking about that policy and regulatory point a bit more, certainly over the course of the past few years, I think it's become much clearer that the environment that companies are going to be operating in, although there is still work that has to be done, are there any countries that are really leading the way on the policy front? And are there any lessons that have been learned to date that other countries should be taking note of?
This was a key focus at COP28. It was around the need to have cooperation around the certification standards for hydrogen. You know, to be able to facilitate a global economy for this, there needs to be recognition of standards and certifications from around the globe to be able to facilitate that global market. In terms of, you know, where we're seeing the right lessons or right approach, again, you know, probably a little bit biased, but in the UK, I think they've done an awful lot to get the policy and the regulation and the business models right. And they are probably, you know, at the forefront of this. Everybody's kind of looking at the US in terms of the IRA and how that is going to support investment. But I think there are challenges and people are still kind of working through exactly how all the kind of the rules and requirements around investment in the US is actually going to bring forwards production. People are still working through those rules and regulations. And I think maybe they need to kind of look around in other jurisdictions to get an idea as to how other countries are putting these things together. If you look at maybe Japan as well, they are, you know, seen as a very kind of large potential kind of export market. And, you know, they have unique constraints compared to other jurisdictions when it comes to kind of decarbonizing their economy. You know, they don't have significant natural resources and kind of natural gas of their own. They don't necessarily have the same level of renewable resources that other countries have as well. So maybe they need to be a little bit more pragmatic about, you know, the hydrogen certifications and the standards, just to allow them to actually make progress into their decarbonization targets, and, you know, tighten up over time and maybe align more, you know, with global markets over time. But I think it's probably something to consider that not everybody's starting from the same position, and there needs to be a little bit of flexibility when it comes to how people achieve their decarbonisation targets.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. And I guess the challenge that policymakers are going to have to weigh up is whether it will, the difference in certification and the diverging of standards ultimately might make longer term trade more challenging. Possibly there's something that we could think about in terms of how the low carbon hydrogen standard has been set up and what that's really incentivized to do.
Yeah, and if you look at the UK, for example, all of the business models have been designed with domestic production and usage in mind. It's not been designed with an eye on exports. And I think the government would also be very kind of reluctant to be seen to be subsidizing production in the UK for use in an export context. So I don't think necessarily that the difference of standards between Europe and UK causes a significant issue at present. But over time, you know, and as hydrogen actually starts to develop and maybe in the UK may in time become an exporter to other markets, then yes, we'll need to see some closer alignment with standards to make sure that people can actually get the benefit of sourcing hydrogen from the best possible sources.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think it's important as well that we recognise that we are in very, very early days here. Just thinking about some figures that we've seen from Bloomberg recently on the scale up of investment in hydrogen over the past year, more than 100% increase. According to the numbers that they've put together, which kind of really highlights to us that actually, although we're worrying about a lot of these problems, as time goes on, as investments are being made, as we learn more and more, I think it is likely that we will discover how to meet some of these challenges and the economy will evolve to help us reach net zero. So it's a super exciting time to be involved in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, this is the end of the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Emma. It's been a pleasure.
That was Emma Woodward, Aurora's European Hydrogen Market Lead, talking to Andrew Doyle, Executive Director at MUFG. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to subscribe on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening and goodbye.